want to start?
Yeah.
Sure.
Task oriented here.
Explain this to us.
Explain it to you.
Explain.
Explain why philosophers write this way.
Hey, I'm not a philosopher. I don't have to justify that. Thank God is all I can say. I mean, I don't know. There are obviously a lot of verbiage in this chapter. You could probably reduce it to use a.
That's the question, can you, right?
To a number of basic points, some of which he makes, some of which he doesn't make. And I think it's interesting which ones he makes and which ones he doesn't make. I mean, clearly, one very fundamental distinction that comes through in this chapter, to me at least, and is one that we've made a lot in here, which is the distinction between nature and science. Claims about nature are one thing, claims about a science of nature, claims about theory, for example, are something else. And I think that's really. That's just a distinction you have to keep in the foreground at all times. And I think he tries to do that. That's the first thing. The second thing, and therefore, for example, that's the basis for his whole discussion of reductionism, obviously. That you can't, that properties aren't predicted, statements about properties are what are predicted. You don't deduce properties, you deduce statements about properties. And therefore, all of the restrictions that are characteristic of logic and language together, and language meaning obviously any propositional form in mathematics, are characteristic of reductionism. And reductionism is a question of science; it's not a question of nature. And I think you know his distinction of his analysis of the reduction of thermodynamics to statistical mechanics. Makes quite clear to me, and I buy it. I mean, I'm not a physicist, so I'm not a physicist thing about this, but certainly the logic of it seems to me to make eminently good sense, which is sort of a combination of two things. You can't have terms in the conclusions of a logical argument that are not in the premises. And that's one thing. The second is that the term temperature has, for all sorts of reasons, meanings at the level of thermodynamics, which do not exist at the level of statistical mechanics. And therefore, the reduction requires a coordinating definition in which you define thermodynamics in terms of mean kinetic energy of molecules. And there's nothing wrong with that, and that's a perfectly good thing, and it requires, and, you know, has all of his argument about history, and it requires that the sciences be at the right level of development, et cetera, all of which I think to me makes eminently good sense. But implied in that is something which he doesn't actually specifically say, but which I think is really crucial, which is the whole question of levels of analysis. And for that matter, levels of nature and concomitant levels of theory. That I think Nagel implied in the whole chapter is a belief that it's perfectly reasonable to assume that nature is hierarchically organized, and that at higher levels of nature, properties exist which do not exist at lower levels of nature, and that therefore psychologists do what psychologists do, and neurophysiologists do what neurophysiologists do, and chemists what chemists do, etc. The question of whether any of these sciences could be reduced to another the way thermodynamics was to statistical mechanics is a function of the nature of the theories themselves. Are they precise enough that you could actually formulate the characteristics with the kind of clarity that you need in order to affect the reduction? And clearly, in the case of biology and psychology and what have you, you can't at this state of nature. But there's no in principle reason why that couldn't be done. But it would always have to be done, because of this levels issue, it would always have to be done with coordinating definitions which would allow terms at the higher level, which have meanings that are not present with neither the terms nor the meanings now being the relationship between the terms and laws, empirical statements, what have you, that aren't present at the lower level, to be equated with one another, but where the equation would be what I called in my presentation an extensional equation, that the certain set of conditions at the lower order are necessary and sufficient to apply the term at the higher level, like, if you have the following kind of statistical mechanical system, you can call that temperature. But the reality being that at the level of the higher system, there's all sorts of surplus meaning. That is, connections, definitional connections between the term temperature, for example, or, you know, smelling a rose, for that matter, that simply don't exist at the lower level. So that's one whole argument. And that's the argument that I have come to sort of rely on, and it makes sense to me. Now,
could I interrupt for one second?
Sure.
So, on page 373, he talks about secondary qualities that cannot be predicted by physical theories. Is that what you mean by surplus?
Where are we?
373, middle of the page, first indentation.
Well, no, because I think he, I mean, and the reason for that, first of all, is that that statement, as it's written right there, which he would dislike, confuses the question of science and nature. Right? Properties are a question of nature, and science is a question of science, or theory, or however you want to put it. But I mean, it's a question of sort of what we know, not what is. And so whenever you talk about prediction in the context of this discussion, at least, you're talking about a question of science, not a question of nature. You're talking about whether one system can be logically deduced from another. Whenever you're talking about properties, you're talking about characteristics of entities at different levels of analysis. And I think if he has one main point, it's that you can't confuse those two. And a lot of the lack of clarity in minds comes from failing to consistently make that distinction.
But does that distinction still hold up in the day of computer models? I mean, aren't computer models something that really do have properties? They're not just statements, they actually do things.
But are they theories, I guess is the question. That's an interesting question. Nagel obviously didn't have to wrestle with that.
No, I wondered about that. As I was reading, what would this chapter be like after the
admin? When was this
chapter? 61. I mean, it's a question of one question that seems to me, if I were Nagel, I would want to say, well, wait, let's discuss the difference between theory and model. Is a model actually a theory? A theory, it seems to me, is an explicit claim about the way things are. And a model is an instantiation. I mean, forget computers for a moment. Take the difference between a wind tunnel and a model airplane in a wind tunnel and a theory about the aerodynamics that describe what's going on in the wind tunnel. I mean, I think that's a pretty critical distinction. Now, what happened, you know, whether the kinds of things you work with, for example, are really properly theories or properly models in that context, I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of times the model comes before the theory, that we might, maybe we have a bug in the code, or we do something that isn't necessarily well justified, or it's something that you couldn't really define in an abstract way. It's really it's best described at the level of the model. And then we spend a large amount of time maybe trying to put it in the framework of a theory, or see how it relates to a theory, but it really, it's like the words almost get in the way of the model.
Well, you see, I mean, you have like given real meaning to the word virtual world, that what you're really talking about is you have this virtual world and it's inhabited by models. And so you can go around and sort of explore the properties of those models just the way someone, I mean, you could think of, like, you know, Darwin exploring, you know, new lands and looking at species of things without yet having a theory of evolution, and he, you know, just very carefully categorizing what are the properties of all these various species, and then ultimately a theory might pop out that would, you know, tie it all together. So you're doing the same thing with individual models. You're running little things, seeing what happens, writing down their properties, and a theory might emerge or it might not.
You're right, and I think we can tie this back to Rob's surplus meaning concept in an interesting way. And I've never heard you say justification for your concept of surplus meaning is the notion that there are, what you said, meaningful interactions among things that occur at higher levels of organization. My favorite example of this is Beethoven's symphony, Beethoven's third symphony. Pick your favorite symphony, I don't care what it is.
Right.
Beethoven's third symphony can be represented, is represented, as a series of notes on a piece of paper. It can equally well be represented as a series of ones and zeros on a DVD. It can equally well be represented in a non-digital, what we used to call it, analog form.
What are those things?
As the grooves in a record. All of those different things form a cluster. They only form a cluster at a higher level of organization. Beethoven's symphony exists only at a higher level of organization. It's a meaningful category, but only a meaningful category at a higher level of organization. There is a relatedness among things which has no explanation at a lower level of organization. What you all do is, as Mark was describing it, you look at the relationship among things in some ways the same way Darwin did, but the things you're looking at the relationships among are higher order constructs. And you're seeing relationships among higher order constructs. So in that sense, it seems to me, it's very clear that as you go up in levels of organization, you do indeed get non-reducible things in the sense that there are categories which exist only at and because of the higher levels of
organization. Although not non-reducible in Nagel's sense, because
they are,
you can make these coordinating bridges.
They
well,
are
that's
all,
an important
well,
point
but
there.
The coordinating
that seems like
bridges
a mystical
is
thing.
A very interesting one, because
yeah.
Every one of the representations of Beethoven's symphony is, in fact, reducible in the sense that it is organized matter. There's no challenge to that.
But none of those are Beethoven's
but
symphony is the only problem.
Until you have
what Beethoven's symphony is the thing which makes similar all of different organizations of matter, which in fact are not similar
but
in any other way.
You're missing both which for you is surprising, both context and level, right? That really Beethoven's symphony, in fact, only exists when one of these physical instantiations meets a human perceiver, and then you have Beethoven's
I'm
symphony.
I'm not missing it. It's inherent in it. That is, in order for these higher order organizations to exist, there must be higher order organizations to support them.
Right, but the Nagel point would be that if I knew exactly what your nervous system was doing at the moment you were perceiving Beethoven's symphony, I could in fact reduce the perception of Beethoven's symphony to these lower order phenomena in his sense, which is to say that I'd have to have an extension. I'd have to say, look, this state of the nervous system over time equals the perception of Beethoven's symphony. Now, you and I know that the perception of Beethoven's symphony has meaning beyond simply that state of the nervous system, but that's the same situation with thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, right? The reduction is simply affected by these extensional coordinating definitions in which you say, look, this set state of a lower level system is necessary and sufficient for the existence or the attribution of this term at the higher level. That's not to say that the term at the higher level is identical to the lower level. And I don't think there's a problem with that. I mean, I think that's a perfectly, I mean, as long as that's what you mean by reduction, it seems to me, I have no problem saying that psychology could eventually be reduced to neurophysiology, for example. That doesn't mean that psychology will disappear any more than thermodynamics has disappeared because of the reduction of statistical mechanics.
I have to, you know, Nagel has this discussion towards the end of the chapter about music, which I have to admit I found almost incomprehensible, because I couldn't tell. I mean, he's using, you know, it's this lengthy thing about some and all this stuff, but I got so lost in the morass of his words that I couldn't find point that he was trying to make. And of course he was giving examples which, if you're a musician, would have different implications and different meanings than to a non-musician about the relationship between pitches in the context of isolation and in the context of in a melody. But I couldn't figure out by the end of it which side he was on in the discussion.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, my take on that is just that that's an extended discussion of the fact that holes, the word hole, the word part, and the word sum have vastly different meanings, that you have to be really precise
right.
about what you're talking about. I mean, it's not just the pitches, but obviously phrasing and intonation. And,
right.
You know, and I don't think he has a problem with that. I mean, I think he accepts the idea that things exist at that level. So the melody obviously is at a different level from the individual tones. And the reason for that, and actually I think he also uses that as a lead into the dynamical systems issue at the end with Curler and people like that, which is a very, you know, and he sort of says, look, there are things in nature which cannot be built up from a part at a time from elements. Like a brick wall can be built up brick by brick by brick with mortar, right? There are things in nature that can't be. And I think he accepts that. But the question is, is that really a critical difference? Is it a critical difference in nature? And more importantly for him, does it require a critical difference in science? Do you need a different kind of theorizing for these kinds of organic or dynamical systems than you do for things that can be built up a part at a time? And I think he thinks no.
Thinks no because of extensional coordinating statements.
Well, with regard to reduction. But also, but this is a separate issue.
But doesn't it go the other way, and that's how you would get emergence? I mean, isn't he talking about emergence is the step when you need to use a coordinating statement? Or am I misreading that?
Well, I don't know that he called it. I mean, I don't think the problem. I think he has no problem with the concept of levels of nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you need a coordinating definition when you have theories at different levels of analysis using different language about phenomena that exist at different levels of nature.
But those coordinating statements then are not empirical.
I think they're precisely empirical.
Well, so at least the temperature molecule is got so much peripheral information, and it ties. I mean, he did a really good job of justifying that coordinating statement. But when you just if the coordinating, I could see it just being another sort of vitalism. That's your coordinating statement, but that might not be.
Well, no, I think, but I think
that
that's
not
his
empirical
statement.
Enough.
When he talks about those coordinating statements, remember he makes distinction between three potential types: logical coordinating statements, conventional, and empirical. And he basically says, and he gets rid of logical because logical would just be a tautology that wouldn't do you anything. And he then says, look, the case of thermodynamics and statistical mechanics is both kind of a convention within the theory, and at the same time, also, if you gather data, independent data, you can
right.
actually make an empirical claim about that relationship. And I would say the same thing. Let's say you wanted to reduce, quote unquote, psychological states to states of the brain. It seems to me that, in principle, is what a neuropsychology ought to be about. A neuropsychology ought to be about describing what psychological events go on when the nervous system is doing whatever it's doing, and vice versa. And that would be a completely empirical issue.
But the question about doing that, though, it seems like you're claiming that there would be the surplus meaning at this higher level, where I guess I always thought that higher level was an abstraction.
Well, it can be.
It is.
But if it's an abstraction, then it's actually losing information, not gaining.
Not in the sense that Rob is using it. Going to require a little fiddling with the concept of information, but in essence, what's being said is, and I actually, I want to take you slightly to task on this one too. What you tend to do is to presume that Beethoven's symphony is the perception of Beethoven's symphony. And if you presume Beethoven's symphony is the perception of Beethoven's symphony, then indeed, within limits, one can describe the brain state that corresponds to the perception of Beethoven's symphony. But in fact, Beethoven's symphony is not the perception of Beethoven's symphony. It is an abstraction at a still higher level.
It's the theory, isn't it?
It is the creation by the brain of a larger category. And those things which the brain creates, which are larger categories, are distinct from the perception, and I think are most appropriately characterized as having surplus meaning. The perception, it's not clear to me that you can really make an argument there's surplus meaning there, or surplus information. But the category, in bringing into existence the category, one has literally added a something that didn't exist before.
So if I can just sort of rephrase what I think you're saying. I mean, if we took someone who was really completely tone deaf, that individual would hear what was going on, would hear it, but would interpret what was being heard as noise.
That's correct.
Rather than as melodies
and
with emotional content.
And they would not have the category Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
But you also wouldn't have, I think we're forgetting the important point, you also wouldn't have in Beethoven's Symphony unless you have the appropriate interaction that makes it music. I mean, a set of digital ones and zeros can be decoded many ways. Some ways
absolutely
it would be music. So I think this perception of Beethoven's symphony is a concept based on how the parts are interacting. So there's a third part here, is how are you decoding whatever?
All interesting abstractions.
Let me defend myself. Let me defend myself against Paul, though, for a quick second, because it's related to that.
All right.
See, I think you have to be careful, because it's a question of perspective. So as a psychologist looking at you, at the level of nature, I might be willing to argue that you have a concept, a category of Beethoven's symphony, which is an abstraction, a generalization, an abstraction. I don't know that that's any more Beethoven's symphony than your perception of Beethoven's symphony. I think there is all sorts of surplus meaning because of intonation and phrase and what have you, the perception. But leaving that aside for a moment, I think those are separate things. That is, I would distinguish watching you as a phenomenon of nature that I might be interested in understanding. Your perception of Beethoven's symphony, your concept of Beethoven's symphony. I would also be interested in the physical instantiations that are, okay, so all of those things are relevant. But then I also have, as a scientist now looking at you, I have a theory of your perception of Beethoven's symphony, a theory of your concept, and therefore I have a concept of Beethoven's symphony, not the one I use when I'm listening to it,
sure,
but the one I use when I'm doing science about it. And I think it's really crucial to, again, to always keep those two things separate.
Is that a meta theory of?
No, I just think it's the difference between science and nature. It's except that sometimes epistemological processes are the objects of are aspects of nature.
But
in
fact, that's what
here.
I'm what I want to
yeah
argue
wait
most strongly.
Well,
okay.
That goes around and around.
Hold on. I think for most of you, it is true that your concept of Beethoven's symphony came not from listening to the symphony, but by reading Peanuts. Tell me that's not correct.
The point's understood.
Right.
Nobody's going to testify as to their
so
cultural limitations. But the point's understood. Yeah.
But then what about the individual, the musicologist, who sits down and parses the language that they put in symphony? The musicologist who sits down and dissects it, the music theorist, what is where would that person's process, analysis, fit in this scheme?
It's what I imagine is we have the perception of Beethoven's entertaining individuals. We then have the category Beethoven's entertaining individual. We then have the category Beethoven Symphony as it has been negotiated among a series of different individuals. Those are different levels of abstraction. And so at the level of the category for an individual of Beethoven Symphony, I have such a category. The musicologist's category, Beethoven Symphony, is actually a different category from mine. There will be differences in the category for different individuals. And then there's a negotiated agreement among groups of individuals as to the category. So
okay.
you've got different,
okay.
There isn't a single Beethoven symphony.
That sounds like a theory to me. That sounds exactly what a definition of a theory is.
It is a theory.
Mark said,
well,
no, I think it's not. And the reason it's not is because a theory requires articulation in some propositional. The concept can be completely mute. And, I mean, in the sense that in fact, most of our concepts are, right? So I have a concept of a chair. You ask me what.
Okay. I wasn't sure.
But that's an important distinction. Theories have to be propositionally articulated.
I have just articulated.
You have
a set
kind
of concepts,
of a,
which makes it a theory, maybe.
You know, postmodern. Yeah. I mean, you have this. Everybody's got a different Beethoven symphony, so it is a theory. Whereas there was a previous theory that said there really was only one. Okay, so that's a theory that.
Yeah, but the important point here is not only the existence of multiple theories about the same thing, but this these different levels at which a concept or theory can exist.
Sure. That's a theory, yeah, right.
That seems like a more narrow definition in the way that I would define theory. I don't know, maybe I'll ask my computer science colleagues. Can you have a non-propositional theory? But what would that mean?
It becomes a model. And the models
yeah.
and theories have to be distinguished.
And I guess that's where I live, oftentimes, is sort of straddling that.
I mean, a model can be an implementation of a theory, right?
Well, it could be, but it doesn't necessarily follow that you have to have the theory first.
No, I mean, let's say, for example, let's do.
No, but it is based on
a sort of like intelligent design idea that you have to have the.
Well, that's a theory. You just
no, I mean, you're saying that the theory is the intelligently designed piece, and then you just implement that. But it doesn't necessarily follow that you have to do that. You could have, for example, a program that you, to go with the analogy, you could evolve a program, and then.
Yeah. Okay. So let's say. Just a program to sort
things
out.
There's your theory. You believe you can evolve.
Okay, that's a program, but I wouldn't call it. You could stretch it maybe to call it a model, but you certainly couldn't call that a theory.
No, a program is an instantiation of a model, to some extent.
Right. So,
but it doesn't have to be, right? So you don't have to have something.
No, and I think that's the distinction between doing emergent computation versus the reductionist rational ideas that we're trying to grapple at and. In emergent computation, you really don't have a model. You don't have a theory, you don't have a model, and you build a simulation, and it's very empirical. You build instances, run the programs, observe behavior, and then figure out whether that's close to a natural phenomenon that you're trying to model or not. But it's not based on any specific theory or a model. So you're just letting, you know, the idea behind having several agents and interacting them. So by writing a program in that view, you're just creating this, populating the computer with these agents and then watching what comes out without any model or theory underlying it.
Yeah, I think there are extremes of this. You can be more on one side or more on the other. But this same issue comes up with regard to science and scientific method. Some scientists deny that
they go out exploring using a model or a theory. They assert that they simply go out and observe things. So years ago, Nietzsche in a talk in a seminar made the point the scientific method was an artifact of some kind of science, that she doesn't go out with a theory or a model, she just goes out and looks at the mountains. I think she's wrong. I think it's more a case that she has an implicit theory or model.
And I would say
the same thing with your work, that you are less driven by a particular concept of how things work or should work. You allow more play.
Yeah, I think what ties up some of our work is it's always directed with respect to having some kind of problem-solving notion at the back of our minds. So we're doing this kind of programming or modeling because we think that this may arrive at a solution to a problem which is ill understood, not so well understood. And that's what drives computational modeling of emergent phenomena.
And a set of general expectations about the way in which these models operate when they're built in a certain way and allowed to run. I mean, but the term implicit theory, I mean, it's perfectly fine to use it. But I mean, I think it's, in a way, it's a contradiction in terms, because the whole point of the theory is that it's explicit. And of course, scientists don't always operate with explicit theories, and of course, they always operate with implicit theories. Indeed, you can't sit on a chair without operating with an implicit theory, that the chair is going to hold your weight, and many other things as well. So, I mean, the notion that the cognitive system operates with implicit theories, it seems to me, is so obvious as to be almost trivial. But the issue of explicit theory is a whole different question. And I think Paul's right that that science goes everywhere from really having very explicit theories from which you then deduce testable hypotheses and use observation statements and knowledge of your apparatus to come up with specific expectations about what's going to happen in an experiment, all the way down to people who don't have any kind of explicit theoretical orientation at all. And many times I think some of the big, most important technological innovations, the theory has always come after the innovation. I mean, I don't think that the Wright brothers, for example, had anything like an aeronautical engineer's understanding of the theory of flight, but they made it work, and then after they made it work, people sort of retroactively began to say, now why does it work?
I guess this comes back to my question, though, sorry, Karen, about whether or not the higher level, the theory is an abstraction, an approximation, or is it something that gains meaning?
It's both.
I don't see how it can be both. I mean, if it's an abstraction,
it's totally
throwing away detail.
Yeah. But by throwing away detail, you get this surplus meaning. I'm now kind of a big surplus meaning fan, I decided.
It makes you a non-reductionist, you realize. I hate to tell you.
don't push him.
Yeah.
Let him move quietly without calling attention
to it.
It's fine.
We weren't going to tell him that till he got there.
One confession at a time. So let me just, what I was going to say is, would you agree with the statement that really all science is surplus meaning? Because surplus meaning is really just another word for concepts.
And the relations.
And right. And so, back to Doug's point, what theories do is they abstract from we just discussed this in my class yesterday. They abstract, because I presented a theory, and they go, that's ridiculous, it's too simple. And I go, simple is not an argument against a theory. That's what theories are supposed to be. So they abstract and simplify, okay? So that's the sense in which, from your perspective, they're throwing away information. But they're sort of like, in the process of doing that, you can see relationships, which are the concepts, which are the surplus meaning, that you couldn't see if you had kept all that detail.
Let me say it slightly differently, because it actually fits very closely to how the nervous system is organized architecturally. It is absolutely true that as you create a concept, you abstract in the sense that there are specifics which are tossed away. But in that sense, it's a convergent organization. it's a many to one convergent system. The point, though, is there is no inevitability in the particular convergence. One can converge into a different category. The creation of the category into which one converges is actually an addition of meaning. So you had simultaneously a loss of meaning in the sense, a loss of information in the sense that details are thrown away, but you have an addition of information because the category into which you converge things is not an inevitable category. So
well,
by choosing that category, you have created meaning.
Okay, Karen, go ahead.
Karen would like to say
something. Well, it's not as relevant as it was 10 minutes ago. Something I do want to point out, which is if we look at the current culture of science and the practice of science, at least in the life sciences, there is a pretty strong suspicion of doing science as exploration without explicit hypothesis. It's the difference between hypothesis-driven science and so-called discovery science, which funding agencies don't like, with the exception of the Human Genome Project, which was the first example of big discovery science that was funded. You can't get a grant funded these days unless you have a hypothesis.
And that's cost efficient. I mean, that's the right.
Well, is it though?
Well, you don't have
no,
to have
no, that. I mean, this whole view, I don't know why scientists go around talking like this. It's idiotic that they're just sort of randomly looking at things. The issue is that a more efficient search model, just randomly looking at things, or looking at things given that you have like, you know, one, let's start,
on
starting from the 500 years worth of data and hypotheses and theories that help you narrow your search.
Karen is absolutely right. And you know, there's a years and years ago when I was
that 10 minutes
when I was a young assistant professor.
Before you accumulated all this surplus meaning.
Before I accumulated all this surplus meaning, I wrote after a series of grants that had been funded, I wrote a grant application to the National Science Foundation, which essentially said, "Look, over here is virgin territory. Nobody's been there before. I want to go over there and explore it." And NSF wrote back and said, "This isn't Grobstein. Grobstein is a hard-nosed scientist. He develops hypotheses. We don't know what he's doing now." It really is true that the phenomenon of going into new territory and mapping it has been treated in science as a lesser activity over the last 50 or 60 years, despite the fact that much of the most important science has actually been done that way historically. And what has happened that's very interesting is the Human Genome Project was, in fact, that kind of science.
Yes, I think
and they funded it at a huge level,
boring,
and
but,
because they funded it at a huge level, the pattern is changing for funding in science now. All of the agencies are now saying, Jesus, we have to get in on this new way of doing science.
Well, they may be saying it, but they're not doing it
what
much in
children?
Practice in terms of actual funding.
Yeah.
Well,
that's why you take some
I think
20 years before they can think of something.
Oh my goodness.
In transitioning back, I noticed that Mark was talking about theories and Paul was talking about brains.
Yes, exactly. And let me just say something about concepts because I think it's really an important issue. I mean, the way Paul was discussing it, in fact, the way we were discussing it, was I think as though concepts exist in isolation. And where the surplus meaning comes from is the fact that concepts don't exist in isolation, they exist in systems. So, for example, take your concept of a chair. Of course, there's abstraction in that the redness of the chair and its upholstery and whether it's made of wood all drops out specifically when you think of a chair, right? But, in fact,
the concept of a chair is intimately related to the concept of table and to furniture and to, and so it's the meaning of the concept chair is actually infinitely greater than simply the abstraction derived from a set of objects.
But as you said at the beginning, the addition of meaning has to do with interrelations at the higher level of organization.
And that's
where the addition of
and that's how scientific theories work too, right? Scientific theories are scientific concepts in whole sets of relations that have to do with axioms and postulates and beliefs about the properties of electrons or whatever it might happen to be.
Can I say a couple words about virgins? That this is just this is delusional on the part of scientists that when they're going into virgin territory, they're going in without any preconceptions, without
we absolutely agree.
If you look at the genome experiment, you know, whatever they were doing, there was the whole, you know, theory or concept of DNA behind the whole thing.
Absolutely.
So, for example, I don't know how they do that thing, but, you know, I'll bet you, you know, you have those four proteins, right? Adenine, blah, 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 whatever those things are called.
Building blocks.
Well, that's a protein, right?
No.
They're amino acids.
Nucleic acids. Okay, anyway, whatever they are.
Don't quit your day job.
My point
is the American public. Hey.
Well, at least I knew there were four.
You got the important point.
I bet whatever systems they used probably would have been blind to the possibility that there were six or eight. That there was a whole theory as
this
to what the construction of DNA was that enabled them to go forward.
That
the act of determining the sequence
was, in the view of traditional hypothesis-driven science, it was a purely mechanical exercise of just determining the sequence of A's and C's and T's.
Right,
and
which
G's.
Is why I
that was
it boring.
Mechanical.
It
that's
was,
right.
But the point, Mark, that really is interesting is at the time that biologists urged the expenditure of a huge amount of money to do this, biologists were unable to say why it should be done, except for the vague statement that if we do it, something interesting will turn up.
Well, it's the same exact thing with, cyclotrons.
Yes, that's exactly correct.
Okay, so
and the same thing with the moon exploration,
or
Mars exploration.
Or computational chemistry coming up with new organic compounds, for example.
That's correct.
Seems to me it's the same, basically.
And the truth about the genome funding is that most of the initial funding was in the private sector. It's only after about 10 years of private sector funding that the government got in on it.
Nope. The groundwork had been laid with research with federal funding, but the first chunk of money came from the Department of Defense. That's where the first seed money came.
Well, maybe in the United States.
In the U.S.
No, I'm talking genome research that's been done around the world. You know, when we talk about science, I don't want to necessarily talk about science in the United States. Do you?
I don't know how you can say this. Everything starts with a description. Everything starts with a description. And if you're going into any new territory, that's where you start. You can never...
I'm saying the view that you're just randomly searching is wrong. That you always have a huge, and it'd be stupid. It's not just, you know, it's not just a wrong description or a delusional description of what you're doing.
No, it's the versus.
But it's also stupid. If you were doing it that way, you should get out.
No, the genome project wasn't experimental. You weren't saying, I'm going to control for this and then tweak this over here and see what happens. It was just, I'm going to go in and describe the genome.
Yeah, but there was assumptions about the structure of DNA that completely informed
not
what they
really.
Were doing.
Not really. I mean, we knew what the structure of DNA was, but this was a mechanical exercise out of which all sorts of interesting things emerged. But the actual doing of the sequence was pretty mechanical.
You guys aren't arguing. Mark's correct that nobody goes into new territory without any presumptions.
If we can go back to this abstraction surplus meaning thing, I guess the problem I have with that is that I sort of see symbolic AI is thinking that they can do both of those things. So they come in and they abstract out to these nice concepts, and they think that it will have the surplus meaning, and so they can do intelligence at that level. And I think it turns out that it hasn't panned out that way. And if we actually go down and have this lower level subsymbolic system, then we have these abstractions that come out, and maybe whatever the surplus meaning is as well. But you can't just do it at that level.
Yeah, I mean, symbolic theories in AI came on the basis of philosophy and work in psychology and cognition. So they didn't just come out of the blue. And it is true that, you know, that is the result coming out of symbolic AI. There was a problem with those formal theories of reductionist ideas.
Yeah, but that's not.
However, you know, the promise of subsymbolic systems still remains a promise.
And to put it slightly more positively, it shouldn't surprise anybody that the abstractions alone don't do it. That is, the abstractions
nor can you infer that the abstractions or the theories behind the abstractions are incorrect simply because they don't function the way you expect them to.
They're normally functioning in a multi-layer system. So the fact that they don't function well by themselves isn't to say they're wrong. It's simply to say they're normally functioning in a context.
Well, I guess I wonder in what sense they exist at all except in our mind.
They don't exist at all except in our mind.
But so where does this surplus, then this is just a level of description. But you were saying a minute ago that there's actually something in the brain.
Well, they are something in the brain, but the important point is that
they don't exist at all.
They exist. Their meaning exists only, as Rob said, contextually.
Yeah, I think that was the important point. You can't isolate these ideas or concepts and theories and say, here they are.
That's right.
And they're sitting in this part of your brain. Well, unless your brain is in an environment where you're actually exercising those concepts, that doesn't mean it.
Rob, I have a question. So surplus meaning, just before I jump on that bandwagon, I just want to
make
sure.
You better know where it's going.
No bats.
On it, buddy.
So is that a characteristic of science, which I'm totally willing to agree, but is it also a characteristic of nature too? Or is it just the science characteristic?
It is only a characteristic of storytelling.
Okay, well, I would call that science on our side.
Yes.
Okay.
But I thought it was a property of emergent systems.
If you mean meaning, I would agree with you, but if you mean properties, I wouldn't. I mean, I think properties are characteristics of nature. And at higher levels of complex organization, there are properties characteristic of nature which do not exist at lower levels of organization. But the meaning of those properties is something that human beings assign in the context of theorizing about.
And so is there a difference between meaning and surplus meaning? Surplus meaning is
just that there's at higher levels, there's because the properties, I mean, I'm still a realist, I hope. So then the idea being, because these properties at higher levels of complex organization need to be described and understood, we invoke levels of meaning which involve surplus over what we would in understanding and describing.
But there's surplus. See, I'm only a half convert. I would say there's surplus meaning even on our understanding of the lowest levels.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes.
And, you know, reductionism explains a lot of phenomena really well. So there's no reason to reject that idea. I mean, I hope we're not arguing that that's just not a good idea or arguing against reductionism.
So do we believe you that properties are real things? These properties, these higher level properties in nature, because they're in nature, are real things.
I think
they're not our surplus.
They're as real as nature is.
Okay, so they're not these things we're calling higher level properties.
are not simply the reflections of our surplus meaning concepts.
I would, no. So, for example, I mean, it's like a tree falls in the forest kind of idea, right? I don't think it's necessary for any human being to be around for a thunderstorm to put out at the beginnings of the forest fire.
Right. For starting.
That is the property of water, is that it, you know, in nature, it does certain things. And so that's a property, but it's a property at a higher level. Now, if you want to theorize about why it does, then you need a description and explanation at a higher level of meaning with concepts that have surplus meaning over and above the one you bring to just talk about hydrogen and oxygen.
Gloss this for me. One of the interesting things that Nagel does is he splits two kinds of emergence. Does that help in this? I mean,
well, he really does.
The question whether any properties are emergents in the sense of being temporally novel,
right,
is a problem of a different order from the issue whether any properties are emergents in the sense of being unpredictable. So
but
the unpredictable
really
and the novel are distinct. The latter is an issue largely concerned with logical relationship statements. The former is primarily a question that can be settled only by empirical historical.
Right, but unfortunately, you know, I think as great as this chapter is, despite all the verbiage, and as brilliant as this man was, I think he conflates some things there that are not helpful. There's the question of the science, and then there's the question of nature. So that's an important distinction.
Yeah.
Then there's the question of levels. Which is a separate question from logical predictability and logical deducibility. And then there's also the question of novelty. And so if you go back to when I very first made that historical presentation on emergence, so distinguishing between epistemological emergence and ontological emergence, science and nature, but then also between developmental emergence or evolutionary emergence and the question of levels. So I think he believes quite clearly that nature exists in levels. Whether or not that's an evolutionary issue for him is an empirical one. You have to go back and see whether new levels of complexity have come into existence that previously didn't, and bring evidence to bear on it.
So that's the distinction.
Right.
I mean, temporal versus.
Right. Or evolutionary versus hierarchical. Exactly. I think that's the way to put it.
And he claims that in some cases, eventually, with the new theories and concepts, you can then reduce them.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was a clear argument. He says, as things evolve, like the first idea of an atom didn't allow you to deduce very much. But as those evolve, then all of a sudden you can use them to reduce. So how do you make the cut between something that's non-reducible and reducible?
Well, I don't think you do. I think everything for him is potentially reducible. And I have no problem
with
that idea.
I think that's what he was
saying. But where reduction simply means bridging these levels with coordinating definitions. That's the key thing. If you realize that reduction doesn't mean getting rid of the higher level system, it doesn't mean describing the properties of the higher level system in terms of the properties of the lower level system only, but simply being able to establish these coordinating definitions so that in principle you could deduce the laws of the higher system from the laws of the lower system, but with the recognition that there's surplus meaning at the higher system, I don't have a problem with that. I think that's what reduction is. I think at least he's convinced me that the only really successful reductions have been of that sort, but I think we get a kind of knee-jerk reflex
that's
when somebody says reduction.
That's operational definition, but is there really, that doesn't help me understand whether there's nature, ontological emergence, though. To me,
evolutionary or levels?
Both. I think he's saying you might be able to reduce them all eventually, given enough concept evolution.
But reduce doesn't mean, reduce has nothing to do with nature. Reduced for him is only a question of science. So nature could have evolutionary novelty, and you could still reduce it as long as you could deduce the evolutionary novelties from descriptions of prior events. And you'd have to do that using these coordinating definitions, because the evolutionary novelty brings levels of complexity which didn't previously exist. So I don't see any conflict between those.
Except that sometimes we call something emergence, or we want to call it emergent, and then later when we've evolved a little bit or the concepts evolve, we say, well, that's not really emergent. Now they're linked this way.
But see,
yeah, that's
Rob's
you know what I mean?
Just
I want to make that cut. When
Rob's
use emergence?
Well, there's scientists working all the time to deduce things from, you know, deduce higher things from lower things. They may succeed, they may not. But Rob's point is, even when they succeed, it's still a higher thing.
Right.
And there's still surface meaning in the thing, blah, blah, blah.
Well, maybe there's something else that we can read later on. I know Tim's going to talk next week. Maybe, Rob, if you know of something else that we could read that might explore this further, that we could take a look at.
I can look.
Okay.
Nothing comes to mind.
This idea of levels of nature, is that something that people have written about?
Well, I'm sure in systems theory there's discussion
yeah.
of it, but I don't know. It's not a literature I know very well that we can probably.
Well, if anybody knows of something, I would like to read more about this, and I still don't quite get surplus meaning, so I'd like to come to that.
Well, I asked this guy, he knows.
Yeah, you're driving the bandwagon now.
Like
you
should throw it away.
That's not like
me. Yeah. I know it's awesome.
My unifying surplus meaning
you know
and reduction.
It even has the scene.
Oh, that's great.